Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call and talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Friday's now all about food and fun here at WAMC. We have been doing this since the beginning of the year and we'll do it forever. We have some fantastic folks in the studio with us on this Food Friday, for whom bread is their bread and butter. That's what it says here in the script. Matt Funicello is the man behind the Rock Hill Bakehouse in Glens Falls, New York, which has been serving delicious hearth-baked bread to the region and beyond since 1995. He uses only wheat grown here in New York State. He gets up ridiculously early most days of the week to bake bread. He'll tell you a thing or two about it. June Russell is the manager of farm inspections and strategic development for Green Market Grow NYC. She has been a baker and spearheaded efforts to bring grains and local flour back to the Northeast through the Green Market's Regional Grains Project. Matt, June, welcome to the show. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Ray. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Ray.
If you at home want to join the conversation, we would love that. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can connect to us in modern ways, and I will enumerate those for you now. Here we go. You can post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. That's one. You could comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WAMC Radio. That's two. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. That's three. Or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. That's four. Now, call-in shows don't really work without calls, so we would hope you would call as well. 800-348-2551 is our number. With the preamble out of the way, now I can officially welcome June and Matt to the show. Nice to have you guys here today.
Thank you very much for having us both, Ray. Very much appreciated.
Before we start, a thing or two about Funicello. Sandwich genius, okay? I have to say this. I have to get it off my chest. Every fun drive, I wait excitedly because one day of that fun drive, he'll bring lunch and sandwiches, you don't put with genius very often, but you make a sandwich. You make a good sandwich.
Next fun drive. Well, it's here upon us right now. I'm going to bring you a curry chicken grill because I don't think you've had the pleasure yet.
No, but I love curry chicken.
It's a sandwich that is best made, served hot, of course, right off the panini, but you're going to have to get it a little bit on the colder side and warm back up again, but you're going to love it. That's our flagship up at the cafe in Glens Falls for sure.
Very, very exciting. And June, you handed me a list. This is great. It is 15 reasons to eat locally grown grain. I didn't know that, number one, there was such a huge amount of locally grown grain.
Well, we started with coming up with 10 reasons and we couldn't stop. So we went to 15 because we were having so much fun developing good reasons. And there hasn't been very much locally grown grain. This is still the newer edge of the local foods movement where grains are really coming into production and starting to be available.
But there seems to be so many now, so many different kinds. When did that start?
Well, I think that has been around since antiquity. The question would be, when did we lose it?
Okay, well, that's more or less my question. I look old, but I have not actually been around since antiquity. So to me, it's just coming back.
I think, our whole food system has gone towards large-scale efficiencies.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'm sure Matt has seen trends over the years that you've been baking where we've certainly lost some diversity that we may have had when you guys first started. But pretty much white flour and probably all-purpose flour has just dominated the market for the last 20 years.
And in a pinch, that's okay, right?
Historically, one of the interests... No, it's definitely not okay.
Not okay? Yeah. Well, not for a bread genius, obviously.
I'm not a bread genius. I'm a regular guy who grew up on a subsistence farm.
Okay.
So I grew up with great food.
Mm-hmm.
We grew it. We grew almost all the food that we ate ourselves. I hated it while I was living the experience. Didn't appreciate it at all. So it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Taking care of all the animals and weeding the garden by hand. You know, it wasn't a big farm. It was the small kind of farm you'd imagine from your Playmobil set from the 1960s.
Sure.
You know, variegated, very small number of each kind of animal. The vegetable garden was an acre and a half that, you know, again, we tended by hand. It was not a cultivated farm.
Mm-hmm.
But what June is talking about, to get back to that, is very interesting, which is that if you look at the centralization of agriculture post-World War II, we really decided that New York State, which had been and most people don't realize this, the breadbasket of New England mm-hmm. for 100 years at least, if not far longer. We grew our own wheat. We grew our own grains here. They weren't grown in the Midwest and shipped out here by train. We grew them. Now, what happened to all of that post-1950 is amazing, which is we convinced, using really a banking system and the centralization of agriculture, the farmers to convert to growing corn and hay and feeding cows and providing us with milk. And that's what New York became, was the dairy state. And we stopped producing wheat in volume. Large portion of the reason for that is that as you kill an industry, you also kill the processing of it, and we lost our milling. Mm. Now, what a lot of farmers told me about 20 years ago when we were looking at, we partner very closely with Champlain Valley Milling, a gentleman named Sam Sherman up there who's been, to say the least, a pioneer in recreating not only a market for organic grains, which is his primary niche, but also trying to find farmers regionally in Vermont and New York State who are actually growing wheat and grain to mill. This is a guy who knows how to mill them. That was a rarity 25 years ago, because what had happened was you might have a farmer interested in growing an acre or two of wheat to see how it goes. But after he's done, the best he could do was on a rudimentary level, grind it. It was a grinding process more than it was milling. Milling's a science. It's an art. And June can probably speak more to that than I can. But the thing is, what we've seen over the last 25 years, since Rock Hill has been around, is that you are looking at a situation where I could only buy a few thousand pounds of New York State or regional flour back in the mid to late 80s when Rock Hill began. By 2000, I was able to buy 15 or 20,000 pounds of New York State wheat. This year, and again, it's a misnomer from the script that we use all New York State flour. We do not.
Okay.
We use a lot of New York State flour, most of it from the Watertown area. This year, it'll be roughly 300,000 pounds of flour. Which is roughly a third. It's 20% to a third of what we're using when it comes to unbleached, unbromated wheat flour for our bread.
All right,
it's huge.
So let me ask you a question. Aside from the political decision you have made and the socioeconomic decision you have made, from a taste standpoint, what do you gain from using a New York State or a locally grown
wheat? Well, I like how you've completely removed the political
aspect. Because we know you've stated that you grew up on a subsistence farm and you want to see that sort of smaller agriculture grow locally and regionally. But from a taste standpoint and from an ingredient standpoint, what do you gain?
I'm very mercenary about those things because I believe you have to sell that idea to the other bakeries and the other businesses that might use that ingredient. So I do usually stay away from the principled reasons of supporting local and regional and sustainable or organic, better yet, and get past that to this is a fresher food.
Right.
This is not a flour that has been processed and left to sit for long periods of time on a loading dock somewhere or in a storage facility. It has not been treated so that it will withstand that type of distribution.
Made to be used fast.
It's made to be used much faster. Now, there's an argument to be made with something like bread, where development is key and you might be adding something like sugar or yeast or a dairy product to the or an oil or an emulsifier to the bread product. For me, that's never been an issue. I've never baked bread that contains anything but flour, water, salt, and maybe some other organic ingredients put in like nuts or cheese.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, we're dealing with a very basic ingredient there. So the flour becomes so intrinsic. And if that wheat does not have a great flavor, you're going to notice it in the bread. Likewise, if I'm all of a sudden being able to buy thousands of pounds of New York State flour that is fresher and has more germ to it, and I'm going to eat that bread and I'm going to put that next to a loaf that was made with Midwestern wheat. I like to call the people who grow wheat in the Midwest the wheat mafia. It's very centralized, monopolized industrial
big
mechanism.
Business. Yeah.
It's a commodity. We're getting away from that by doing business with a farm that only has a few thousand acres of wheat as opposed to 10,000 and is lumped together with 30 other farms that big.
June, has this grown? Has this trend grown?
Sure. And it's really just beginning. I'm part of a group that is working on a grant project, a 4-year-long grant project, to grow out some, to field test some varieties, different wheat varieties, also Spelt and Emmer. And after 2 years of growing out those trials, we had enough to work with And last weekend, Matt, we missed you. We did some. We did
that
some.
Was I was honestly baking.
Okay, fair enough.
You were invited. We
for
wanted
real.
You to be there. And we did some bake testing of those varieties that had the promising agronomic aspects because, you know, going back to the beginning, we've lost our seed source. We don't know what's adapted to the region, or we have to find varieties that could do well in this region. So, and we did the bake test, and that was followed by a sensory evaluation, and we did a taste testing. And so I think we're just hitting, you know, the tip of the iceberg here, and flavor components in wheat has been not a part of the conversation until recently.
So the variety of what we get to taste is much wider now than maybe 20 years ago.
Well, sure. I mean, they've a lot of the seed sources, though. I mean, there have been a few people who have been sourcing seed stocks from the Middle East and the Georgian Caucasus, and, you know, very small scale. And we're getting a hold of some of those and trying to grow them out to a larger amount to where you could actually bake with them. You know, in those areas, they've kept them alive for thousands of years, but they're making flatbreads and, you know, different kinds of breads than Matt is making.
Right. This is great. Now, this is a good spot to take a break. We're with June Russell, Manager of Farm Inspections and Strategic Development for Green Market Grow NYC. Also, Matt Funicello from the Rock Hill Bakehouse in Glens Falls, New York. And I promise we'll get to your calls next. 800-348-2551 is the number.
Support for WAMC comes from Pangea, North Bennington, Vermont. Contemporary American cuisine prepared with local sustainable ingredients featuring international beer and wines. VermontFineDining.com and Facebook. Woodstock School of Art, Woodstock, New York. Offering classes and workshops in drawing, painting, printmaking, sculpture, and more. Tuition assistance available. All levels welcome. WoodstockSchoolOfArt.org. Ward's Nursery, Garden Center, and Wild Bird Shop, Great Barrington. For wild bird lovers, feeders, suet, black oil, sunflower seed, thistle seed, and more bird specialties, wardsnursery.com. And Lewis Sign Company, a family business celebrating 90 years in the community, supplying signs, LED message centers, digital printing, vehicle wraps, sign and lighting service. Tell the world with signs, lewissigns.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Food Friday, don't you know? 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Matt Funicello is here. June Russell and your calls. And we start with Mark in South Glens Falls. Hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm good. Just wanted to make a comment. I wanted to thank Matt for putting Rock Hill Bakery in South Glens Falls. It's unbelievably good, from the jalapeno cheddar to the pan paisano.
Are you a ringer? Did he make you call, Mark?
Well, no, he didn't. But the only complaint I have is that I go there way too much. And it is excellent. Excellent.
It is indeed.
So thank you.
Thanks a lot.
It is the best bread I've ever had. And I'm 60 years old. So thank you.
Mark, I can't thank you enough.
Good call.
And you are very welcome. But I located in South Glens Falls by accident. I still had business partners in 94 when we moved there. From the farmhouse we began in, and we did not expect that we would be there still to this day. It was a transitional decision. We were just going to be there for a few years. The very first customers we had at the cafe we set up there, very small, a couple hundred square feet, for the first two or three weeks it sustained us, were all from the local trailer park, which I thought was absolutely fantastic. What an eye-opening experience to see that you can locate in the middle of your supposed demographic, or you can locate right next to a bunch of working-class people like yourself, and they'll support you gangbusters, and they still do.
It's a good lesson.
Wonderful place. Love it.
Mark. Yes, and thank you very much, and please don't ever go away.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mark. 1-800-348-2551. June Russell of Green Market Grow NYC. Now, I haven't said Jane Russell once. I know I'm going to slip at some point. June Russell of Green Market Grow NYC and Matt Funicello of Rock Hill Bakehouse with us. Dawn in Del Mar. Dawn, you're up.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm on a wheat and dairy-free diet. I feel like nobody wants to hear my needs. But living in Del Mar, I can't get fresh bread. on a regular basis, not in Price Chopper, not in ShopRite, not in Hannaford. And sometimes we have a small health food store here. Some off and on they have fresh bread. So I have to pretty much go to the co-op, but that's a bit of a trip. So one thing I'm wondering is, I recently saw the article in the Times Union about using a bread machine, and I'm wondering if that makes sense. I mean, I really don't want to have to make my own bread, but how else can I get, a fresh loaf of bread so
fair
I don't
question.
Have to just be buying frozen?
I've got two pretty good answers for you. It's Dawn, right?
Yes.
One is don't be afraid to use a bread machine because you're going to end up being able to use amazing raw ingredients. You can go to your local co-op. Being down here, I think there's a great co-op in Delmore, but there's also, of course, Honest Wait. You can travel up north and go to Four Seasons or Pure and Simple in our neck of the woods. You can use some amazing grains and experiment with them on a fairly small level. That's the great thing about a bread machine.
Okay.
The terrible thing about a bread machine is you can't get any reasonable crust out of it. And for those of us who like a nice, chewy, leathery crust on our bread, it's never going to happen in that machine. But it might give you enough motivation that once you find a recipe or a combination of ingredients you enjoy, you can then take the next step to kind of firming up that dough a little bit, hydrating it a little bit less, and starting to bake it with a stone or a cloche in your oven. But
to tell you the truth, I don't even mind if I didn't have a nice crust, because what I find with some of the wheat-free breads is that they are like mushy and doughy in the center.
Well, I'll tell you the only one I've had that I really so far, and I mean again, I'm not out there experimenting with them regularly, and I'm not certainly living a wheat-free existence myself by any means whatsoever. Okay. But I have a friend who has a daughter with celiacs. I have a number of friends who are either living a gluten-free diet or who have maladies that are causing them to. I have brothers with wheat allergies. So I'm quite familiar with the seriousness of it.
Okay.
I'm also, familiar with those who are choosing not to eat processed modern grain. I mean, it really on many levels isn't good for you. That seems to be kind of not on a paleo level, but on a primal level, that only makes sense. How can a body that was acclimated to eating fresh fruit from a tree in a 10,000-year period all of a sudden acclimate itself to eating this pulverized and treated commodity we call modern flour? That's
right.
One of the reasons why people like June that are doing this amazing work to bring about grains that are much closer to being whole grains, that are raised organically and processed organically, that's going to help us digest grain. We can then, I think get our bread fix, but without hurting the digestive system. I recommend without any hesitation, Saratoga gluten-free. They are wonderful, and it isn't widely known, and it's not something that's widely distributed, but they do a wonderful job, in particular for people who love crust like me, with rolls. So if you buy the smaller sizes of their breads.
We can't always get them down. You'd think that we were in Siberia, but
it feels like Siberia.
Is there no chance that Rock Hill Bakery will make something?
Well, I tell you, one of the things about Rock Hill that we need to try and do all the time is be honest in every aspect. And we're using almost 1 million pounds of wheat flour every year in our facility.
Right.
And we certainly lack the capital to be able to separate that.
So in other words, you need
to
completely
create another
separate
one.
Facility.
To do this the right way, you really do.
Yeah.
So for us, it's not just that we'd have to see it as being marketable. We'd also have to have some amazing financial wizard who also has, a couple $100,000 in the bank, who decides this is a wonderful idea and he wants to help us build
that mechanism.
Well, hopefully
he's listening today.
That's nice.
Or
Dawn,
she.
Thanks a lot, Dawn. We appreciate the call. And it's lovely to have everyone here on Food Friday. Matt Funicello and June Russell. And some tremendous bread. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall, is here with what do we have here?
Well, I brought only one type of bread for you, Ray, and that is the Jewish rye bread that we make.
I love it. Love rye.
Mimi Sheraton, about a year and a half ago, called this the best rye available, I want to say, on the east side of the Mississippi.
Okay.
Which I take.
That says a lot, because New York is on the east side of the Mississippi.
It surely is.
Yes.
And this is, of course, she is in New York and writing for the New York Times.
Yeah.
And is familiar and was familiar with our rye from 25 years ago when we began selling at the Union Square Green Market, which is where June is coming from. But there are many elements to this bread that make it very challenging for us to produce, not only that make it interesting to eat.
Why is it a chore?
It is probably the most difficult bread for us to make from start to finish, and that is because even though it's a yeasted bread, it's made with a yeasted starter called a poulish.
Okay.
And that is just the French name for Polish, and it's a Polish technique.
All right.
Of that you take a small amount of yeast, you add flour and water, so it's basically a yeasted starter.
Okay.
It's almost like a slurry. It's very wet and loose. You let that grow for a period of 4 to 5 hours at room temperature. You add a little bit more flour and water. You're feeding it, basically. In this process, you then end up with a finished poulish that can be used to make your dough for the day. So about 8 to 10 hours from the time you mix that initial starter, you then have your yeast.
That's why you get up very early in the morning.
Or at night. We start this process at 4 o'clock in the afternoon to be finished with it sometimes at 6 or 7 o'clock the next evening. But the rye also has a mother. It has a sour. We use old in it, which is you bake bread purposely that you're going to soak in water, that you break up, and then it's re-added to the recipe to give the inside of the bread a chew that it wouldn't have otherwise.
Now, wait a minute. You bake some bread and then break it up and put it in?
We soak it in water in a refrigerator, and then basically we use that and we put that back into the recipe. And this, of course, is technically the way the bread, we call ours Jewish rye. We do that because this is very much a traditional way of baking rye bread that was brought to the city by Jewish immigration in the early parts of the 20th century.
It looks amazing, and once we take a call, I'll take a bite. In fact, let's take a call. Margie in Rhinebeck, you're on, or is it Margie?
Yeah, it's Margie. I just had a question if you've ever heard of Graham flour. It was something I had when I was little, and then it went away, and I just have never seen it again, and I was just wondering if you knew anything about that.
Sure, you can still find graham flour in a few places. Usually they're the ye olde mills that are still in operation. But it's just a whole wheat flour because Graham, who was a nutritionist, believed that the whole grain had the best nutritional value, and he wasn't wrong about that. So a graham flour has all the components, the germ, the bran, and the starch all in it still. So basically it's just a whole wheat flour.
So where would you suggest trying to get a hold of some?
Well, you could, I mean, not many places call it graham flour anymore, but you could, if you buy a whole wheat flour, that's what you're getting.
Yeah. Okay.
But
great.
I would get, I mean, if you're also looking at, here's a pitch for the local, you don't want something that's been denatured so that it's shelf stable. Get a fresh flour. A fresh flour that's going to have the germ still in it. And that also means that it will have a shelf life. That germ contains a little bit of oil, which will go rancid. So fresh flours have to be used within, if you keep them in good condition, about six months maybe.
Oh, it's still a long time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these are meant to be used. Some people are like, will it last 2 years? I'm like, no, you bake with it. You eat it. It should be in rotation.
Margie, thanks for the call. How in olden times, Mesopotamia, would they be able to take the harvest and store it for a whole, you know, non-growing time?
Well, there were several ways. They turned it into beer.
No, that's one way. Doesn't last long in my house.
No. Yeah, right. I was going to say.
But it was, I mean, I think it was one of the first storable crops where they were able to keep reserves, and that helped cities to grow and, you know, civilization to evolve. Unfortunately, I haven't had the time to read up on my history, but I look forward to that.
Pshaw, you call it civilization.
Now we get into the political aspect. It's like being up at the bakehouse. You know, this is good. This Jewish rye is good, man. Really good.
Those caraway seeds, too.
Yeah, it is.
We make an unseeded rye, and we've been mercilessly attacked.
No, some people just don't like the caraway seeds.
I refuse to make rye without caraway seeds. It's sacrilege.
Is it like a martini without gin? It's got to have that to be.
Absolutely.
All right, let's go to Betty in Kingston. Betty, you're on. Hello. Oh, you got to turn your radio down, Betty. It's really loud.
Oh, my radio's not on.
Well, then something odd is happening. Well, you're on.
I'm on a cell phone.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to tell Rock Hill that I love their bread. I'm an ex-New Yorker who's lived up here for years, and I miss the Jewish rye from New York.
Oh, it's good.
I'm also very involved in the sustainable community and do lacto fermenting and sell it at my local co-op.
So, Betty, that's wonderful. Thank you very much. For lacto-fermenting and for supporting your co-op.
What is lacto-fermenting? You might as well tell us.
And also for your kind words, too.
And, it's really, I only buy two breads around here, and that's bread alone and your bread. So,
fair enough.
Well, thanks, Betty.
Because I don't like breads with honey or sugar in them or anything like that. And I'm pleased to have that and excited that we're getting local grains. Also, I use some of the products from the Hive, you know, the one across the river.
Wild Hive Farm. Mm-hmm. That's Don Lewis in Clinton
Wild
Corners.
Hive, yeah. Wild Hive. They don't really make products so much as grains to use.
Right.
And I just think that it's great that we have that here, and I hope that it keeps growing in terms of having these local products available, because it's a big growing thing. Hello, are you still there?
Well, we are. We're listening. Listening to you, Betty. Thanks for calling.
I've never done this before.
You did great, and thank you very much. What is lacto-fermenting? You have to tell me now.
No, she's
not
off.
Betty. You. I'm talking to our panel.
I'm not going to touch that one.
Why?
At all.
Well, you're a master fermentation, right? No.
All right.
I probably should explain this at the beginning of the hour. No, it really is not. Essentially, when you're making a sourdough starter, there are a number of different ways that you can do that. But the science of it is actually by the half of a percent of us who attempt to understand it is a very infinite subject. And there are lots of differing opinions about why microbial and bacterial activities occur and what exactly is a virus or a fungus or fermentation. So I like to stay away from all that because I am not a scientist. I'm a bread baker.
All right, fair enough.
And what I do is I understand that if you look at our starter that we're producing, one of the ways we do that is with lactobacillus. And it is playing with the idea that we're going to ferment it. We're going to allow it to begin to sour. We're going to allow that process to begin.
Okay.
And then we're going to bring it back from the edge. There are bakeries that do this as an exact science. And then there are bakeries like ours that use this more as a rough guideline.
Okay.
I go more by feel. When I'm talking about doughs and starters, I don't have an exact process.
Is there a danger involved?
Almost every day. Things can explode.
Reluctant.
Right?
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's alive.
No.
Well, it is a living thing. I mean, that's the thing that people forget about bread is that you've got, and especially when you're working with the whole grains, is that there is a fermentation process that's happening, and that those organisms are feeding off of the natural sugars that are in the grain. Now, some folks who are calling in with gluten issues, and I would recommend that they really try to figure out where they fall on that spectrum, because celiac is zero tolerance.
Exactly.
That's certainly an autoimmune condition, and no one should mess with that. But there is a good number within the population that are reporting allergies or intolerances. Now, there's several theories about why that might be happening. We don't know enough yet, but maybe in 5 years, hopefully we will. But one of the theories is that we're eating our bread and flour and grains totally undercooked in the way that they're not going through fermentation, and fermentation helps your digestion.
Interesting.
And so folks who are eating lacto-fermented pickles or sauerkraut, those contain really important digestive enzymes, and that is what's happening, is that the bacteria goes to work and gets the enzyme started.
Yeah.
So instead of going all the way towards something that is gluten-free, which may or may not be good ingredients for us to be ingesting either, if you're talking about cornstarch or potato starch or xanthan gum, to really check out and see if they get a naturally fermented bread of sourdough like Bread Alone does in Rock Hill, that might work for them.
Well, in one of the many bits of printed material that you gave me from the Green Markets Regional Grains Project, one thing that leapt out at me was some of these ancient grains are lower in gluten.
Exactly.
And some people may actually have an easier time with them.
Right. And that's true. I mean, there's definitely a market for spelt. We see in Pennsylvania, and I see a lot more spelt products up here when I go to the Honest Weight Co-op. And there's definitely a population that's tapped into that, that may be having issues with their immune systems, and but can digest spelt. There's been a big
well, and we actually been producing spelt bread for almost 15 years now.
Spelt, explain.
And we use a whole spelt flour. It is Triticum spelta, speltum actually, I think, but it is essentially considered a member of the wheat family by some in the scientific community, and by others they say it's a totally different grain. In reality, the primary difference, and this is what June's actual brochure explains as well, is that these ancient grains are uniquely identified, but that they keep much, if not all, of their nutrient value in the outside of the kernel, in the husk or hull.
Okay.
So you're looking at an inside germ that is not decimating, is not decimated, rather, by the milling process.
Okay.
So it is the other way around when you're talking about modern commercial wheat, where you lose much of the nutritive value through the milling process, which is why we are refortifying your average white commodity flour. You don't need to do that when you're using a whole grain, when you're not removing the germ. So essentially, spelt by its very nature is already better for you. Then you're also talking about that it's raised in very small volumes because nobody knows what it is.
Right.
So it's being raised on smaller sustainable farms, a lot of the time organic as well, because the people looking for an alternative grain are usually looking for something that's not pesticide or chemically processed as well. So we worked with spelt for quite a while. We found it very difficult to deal with. We now work with it seasonally.
So difficult to deal with as far as your recipes?
Well, no. I mean, you have to formulate a recipe around it. I mean, spelt is not something you develop a recipe for and then throw spelt flour into.
Okay.
Like many other regional flours, the interesting thing is that you, as June said, this is a living thing. You're using a sourdough starter. You're using some type of fermentation. This is a living thing. So that living thing behaves differently every day. And it's going to be a different living thing when you get the next shipment of spelt in as well, from a different farm or region, or even from that same farm. So you have to acclimate yourself to the way it's behaving, the way it hydrates, the way it's going to proof, given temperatures, humidity levels, barometric pressure even. Mm. It all plays a part. So it's retraining the modern baker to not have that set recipe and decide, I'm going to get the bread to do what I want. No, instead, you're going to learn to listen to what the bread tells you to do. That's what spelt's all about.
Well put. Matt Funicello is the man behind Rock Hill Bakehouse in Glens Falls. June Russell is the manager of farm inspections and strategic development for Green Market Grow NYC. We'll get back to the phone calls here on Vox Pop on a Food Friday coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Larry's Southwestern Sauces, locally produced Mexican cooking sauces for spicy snacks at football playoff parties, available in New York, New England, and online. Larry'sSouthwesternSauces.com. Casual Set Stuyvesant Plaza, featuring modern women's fashions and accessories, serving the capital region for over 40 years, 518-482-7136. Charles Padula, DDS, Union Avenue, Schenectady, providing bonded composites and air abrasion decay removal, which helps to eliminate needles and drills, PadulaDDS.com. And the Springfield Museums, featuring Intent to Deceive, Fakes and Forgeries in the Art World, exploring infamous art scandals of the past century, now through April 27th, DeMoore Museum of Fine Arts, SpringfieldMuseums.org for info.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551. Food Friday, Matt Funicello and June Russell, and yours truly, Ray Graff. Let's go to John in Saratoga Springs. John, you're on.
Okay. I have two questions, but one has to do with obtaining New York State-grown grain. Is that available in Saratoga Springs somewhere?
Well, John, actually, it's funny that you mentioned that, because we at Rock Hill, which is in South Glens Falls, about 10 miles north of you, it's really in Moreau physically, and the mailing address is Gansvert, but don't let all that confuse you. We're off exit 17N of the Northway. We have a food co-op. The Glens Falls Food Co-op is a consortium of members of the Glens Falls area, citizens rather, who were looking to have a locally owned nonprofit co-op. We already have a great one called Pure and Simple in Glens Falls itself, but we wanted to find a place where you could go for bulk grains and produce. And basically, you can buy New York State grains there. I'm also 100% sure that Four Seasons on Filer Street in Saratoga does carry some New York State and Vermont grains as well. I believe, I want to say Healthy Living in Saratoga has started to carry some too. Again, I think on a bulk level.
Okay.
Okay, well, that's what I'm interested in, getting. What I've done is I recall my mother baking bread, and I've re-inaugurated doing it myself, doing it at home. And I have sent away for cultures for sourdough bread, and I can't seem to make them live or give that distinctive flavor.
The secret, really, and sadly and terribly, and people who are home bakers ask me this all the time at events or, you know, at different shows or events or fundraisers we participate in, you know, how do you make a sourdough starter? How do you naturally leaven bread at home? And the answer is that you really need to nurture and take care of it every other day at a minimum. And most people are not willing to put that kind of time in. We're baking pretty much every day. So, I mean, it's very easy for us to have acclimated ourselves to this living culture's needs and to be able to nurture it. It's not so hard. It's not so easy to do that at home. It really isn't. So you have to develop your own retinue and be committed to it.
All right.
In other words, you have to reinvigorate it every other day or so.
You really do. You need to feed it every other day.
Well, that
okay. Well, that's what I wasn't doing.
June?
Just to go back to the fermentation piece, so you're keeping that culture alive and that it needs food. So by feeding it some fresh flour, you're giving it sugars to keep its own process going. So that's what's happening. And I've heard with some home bakers, you know, they've been able to revive some of their starters that sat in the back of their fridge for a couple weeks.
They cut all the mold off the top. Yeah. And then
nature
they go
is
to
resilient.
Town.
It will come back.
Usually but the acidity in a starter that has sat for a long enough period of time because it's fermented or over-fermented, you're just not going to be able to rejuvenate it and make bread with it. But I've heard that too. I've even had that experience as well.
Okay. So let's go to Tim in Gilderland. Tim, you're on.
Yeah, you mentioned chicken curry a little while back, which
I remember that too.
Yeah, I remember that. Well, anyway, it made me hungry because I really like Indian food, which made me think of naan bread, which I really like.
Yummy.
And this may be a kind of a simple question for you guys, but I've seen it made sometimes where they just take the wet dough and slap it on the side of a hot clay or brick surface. Mm-hmm. And then retrieve it, but it works out very well. And I'm looking around here for a restaurant that does serve it.
I mean, there are a number of fairly decent Indian restaurants, I think, in our area. They're not perhaps New York City or Montreal level restaurants, but they're very good. And there's, you know, from Lake George right on down to Albany and into the Berkshires, Catskills, I can think of a number of them. Mm-hmm. But I have a gentleman working for me who is from Pakistan. His name is Daniel. And if Daniel is out there listening, hello, Danny.
Shout out. Okay. Get back to work.
Danny makes amazing naan, and he brings it into work with food occasionally when we're not too mean to him. He's such a wonderful man. We call him Bapu, and which means, of course, father in India. But he brings us wonderful food, and one of the things is naan. And I always was under the impression that for pita bread and naan and other flatbreads like that, that you want a higher gluten flour. And he actually uses our New York State bread flour. You're probably looking at 11 to 11.5% protein count, which is fairly low. And it makes amazing naan. I love it. So I don't think that the amount of protein or gluten development really matters that much when you're making the naan. It's more a process.
Yeah, and those countries would most likely be growing soft wheats, right, which have the lower protein content. And you only need a higher protein if you're going to do the larger hearth-baked breads that need that gluten structure.
Right. Okay. Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Matt Funicello is here, June Russell, and it is a Food Friday. We're talking about bread, if you haven't discovered that. Mariana in Shelburne Falls, you're on.
Hi. Hi, Ray.
Hello.
Hi. I'm an amateur bread maker.
Okay.
I'm actually...
As am I, Marianne. We all are.
False modesty.
No, really. Really.
Well, I made Bialy's last year for a restaurant in town here, but it's pretty amateur. And so I'm teaching myself how to make Bialy's, and I have tried to make rye bread. And I totally agree with you that it's so hard to make well, I found it really hard to make. But I was wondering, in your adventures of making bread, have you ever heard of or made a bread called, when I was growing up in Manhattan, my aunts lived in Brooklyn and Jewish, and they always would get this bread called cornbread, but it was a rye bread. Do you know anything about that? Or
June is nodding.
I was going to say, I'll let June take that, because I've heard about corn rye bread for the last 25 years and never made a loaf of it myself or ever had any of it.
Yeah,
I'm craving it. I can't find it in Brooklyn anymore, and I go down, you know, every couple of months because I have family.
Yeah, I haven't seen it anywhere, but I do know that, and somebody had brought this to my attention, but that all the recipes from the Laura Ingalls Wilder cookbook were corn and rye, and it would make sense from a colonial perspective because they weren't growing wheat for high gluten content back then. And rye was and still is a grain that does very well under all kinds of really lousy conditions. So you could get a rye harvest, and it also explains why it's been sort of a peasant food for many hundreds of years. And then corn, of course, was the native grain of the Americas. And so combining those two, that probably came out of what was available. And then if you add some wheat to that, you would have a nicer texture than a very dense corn rye bread that they were probably
eating. That Laura Ingalls remark, too, opens a door for me to say something I know I wanted to say earlier, and I'll try to do it quickly because I know we're keeping callers on the line.
Right, you are.
One of the things every home baker who's either waiting on the line and isn't going to get to talk to us, or that they might in the future, because you can get in touch with me or with June through email or through the station, and we'd be more than happy to try to help with any questions you have, is that in one of the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, she talks about making bread with her mother out of the barrel that they got off the train. Now, what they did is they had a barrel of flour that came in. Now, they don't state whether that's rye or wheat, but, you know, as you say, it may well have been rye. They just talk about how you made a little hollow in the center of the barrel of the flour, and you pour water into it. There are no amounts involved here. You pour water in, and whatever amount of flour and water that are absorbing into each other, once that process is complete, you're picking up out of the barrel the dough. Now, that's an interesting way of figuring out what your absorption ratio would be.
Yeah, it's when a you little ever, inefficient, too,
but there's
right?
no recipe. But I tell you what, that is really how you want to be baking. Because the bottom line is that's exactly how much water and flour you should be using. That's the best description I've ever read of it anywhere in my life, and I've read a lot of baking books. That's the one that actually makes sense, is once you can pick it up out of that barrel, now you have the right amount.
That was sort of what happened with my pizza dough last night.
Well, and that's I would say the same is probably true for your corn and rye bread. What we're all afraid to do is experiment, and we all trust recipes. Right. Almost every bread book I've ever read in my life gives me recipes I can't use at home and I'm not having success with. I don't blame the author. I really usually don't. Sometimes I'm mean and I do. But other times I will admit that they're dealing with completely different ingredient than I am. So it's unfair. It's also totally different conditions in my kitchen than where they're baking.
Yeah.
You know, we have to take all that into consideration. Knowing when you actually have bread dough in your hands is that feel is what's important when you're making bread.
A baker said this past weekend, he said, baking is a process. There's not a recipe. And because that, you know, the moisture content, the humidity in your bakery, the quality of the flour, like it's always going to be different. So to become fluent in it really takes quite a lot of practice getting your hands in the dough.
And I say that I'm an amateur, not out of any humility whatsoever, but because every day I am humbled by the reality.
You learned something
new. I didn't do it right today either.
Let's go over to Phil in Amherst. Phil, you're on.
Hi, a couple of things. I haven't been able to find good rye bread made in the United States. I have to import it from Latvia in 18-pound loaves because they say anything smaller, you don't really get a true rye bread.
Did you say Latvia?
Yeah, in Latvia.
We have. We were just talking about this during the break. We have a Finnish baker in the markets down in New York City now who is just going gangbusters. You know, I thought, you know, when I first tasted his bread, it was going to be too intense, but the lines for his bread are crazy. And he has 100% rye. I think he does like a 36-hour fermentation, and it's very good bread. There's no rise to it. It looks like a pancake. But you could look up the Finnish Ruiz, and the name of that bakery is called Nordic Breads. I'm not sure if he ships, but you could look around at his website and see if he does.
Sounds like you could just throw it like a frisbee.
Pretty much, yeah.
Another thing is, do you ever use Sweet Flag
but you wouldn't
in
want
your
to.
Baking?
You wouldn't want to.
Say it again, Phil. I'm sorry.
Sweet Flag?
I'm not familiar with the term.
No.
It's a kind of vegetable that grows in the marshes.
Nope, I have not. I will look into it, though.
It's a medicinal, and it really imparts an excellent flavor to bread.
Sweet Flag.
I appreciate that, and I will definitely check it out.
I remember the Electric Flag, but that was a psychedelic band. Phil, thank you very much.
Or Black Flag.
Well, then that was quite a different band. Renee in Campbell Hall, you're up.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You've already covered Jewish rye, cornbread, and bialys. How about bagels?
Ah.
I'm an ex-Brooklynite, and back like 30 years ago, a bagel was a bagel. Nowadays, it's like some light, fluffy thing that doesn't represent or doesn't taste like bagels used to, unless my memory is just bringing back.
I'm with you, Renee, and the primary reason for that is that the boiling process, the process of actually boiling the bagels prior to the bake and after they have proofed, has been almost completely discontinued, not only because it is an efficiency of production, because it's much cheaper as well, but also because there are issues with sanitation when it's done on a small level. So I think in general, we have ended up with a situation where most bagels are sadly now a product that is made in a huge factory somewhere we don't want to talk about, and then they are frozen and delivered to places that are then heating them up. This is true of bread too, sadly, but with the bagels, the boiling process is what makes a perfect bagel, and you got to find a bagel baker who's actually doing that. You can. They're out there.
So if I were to get the proper recipe, and if I could boil it myself on the stove, the raw bagels on the stove, and then bake them?
Yeah, we don't produce bagels at the bakery, and I never really have done it commercially. I've tried it at home before with very mixed results. I mean, in general, I like to go to Montreal and have a real bagel.
Well, that's the place to go, huh?
I believe so. I mean, New York has some great bagels, too, but I definitely have spent more time in Montreal All than right. New York. So.
Uh-huh. I have one more question.
Sure.
Making a crispy crust on a bread in a homeowner's oven, besides putting a tray of boiling water underneath the bread, is there anything else that works?
There are a couple things you can do that are fairly simple. The bowl of water is kind of a misnomer. The steam is what's really being used in most bakeries. And to give you a quick, we have 3 minutes.
Less than that, actually.
A quick rundown on what we're actually doing in a bread bakery with a hearth in it is that we are actually steam injecting each deck. So we are having water hit iron blocks or cylinders within the oven. It's at oven temperature, 350 to 450 degrees. It's basically filling that chamber. This replicates a traditional hearth oven, which would have a fire built on its hearth. Then when you would remove that fire source and you would get ready to bake your bread, and you would actually mop the entire deck or hearth surface with a wet rag that was taken from a bucket. Very romantic.
Yeah.
And you would swathe the deck of the oven, the hearth of the oven, with this water. Then the steam would rise and you would bake your bread in on top of that. You can't really do that, of course, in a modern metal oven. So what you're going to want to do instead is take a plant sprayer or mister. It's not going to replicate the same mechanism that steam would because it's not hot. But if you take warm water, you gently mist the loaf of bread before you put it in the oven, what's going to happen is you are thickening the amount of dough on the outside that is going to stretch when you have oven spring. So when the CO2 gas that's built up inside that bread as it rises is starting to expand in the oven and the loaf is beginning to grow, you've given it a little bit more time to grow before it sets. Hmm. And that means that your crust is going to end up being thicker, twice as thick, and leathery. It's not necessarily going to be hard. You know, so it'll have a nice chew to it. That's what you're really looking for, usually.
All right,
Renee.
Do you have to open the oven halfway through and spray it again?
I don't necessarily think that matters that much, but you could do that. That's going to make your loaf hard, really, because it's already going to have set at that point.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Renee,
thank you
very much for
thank
the call.
You.
And we want to thank everybody who tuned in. I really don't think we have time to take another call here. We have about 30 seconds. June, wisdom, go.
I was still
okay.
Thinking about baking at home, and
I knew I'd get you.
Use a Dutch oven.
All right, fair.
Put the
I like
on
it.
A Dutch oven.
All right, Matt.
Take the lid off the last 20 minutes.
10 seconds. Wisdom. Go.
Make sure you buy local food, sustainable food. Stop shopping at huge, massive supermarkets unless you're buying local products there, like my bread.
What a fun, fun show this was on a Food Friday. Thanks to Matt Funicello and June Russell. Thanks to everybody.
Go to farmers markets. There you go.
I am sorry if you didn't make it through, but go to our website, WAMC.org, hit the Vox Pop page, and then you're going to find a jumping off point for all the Food Friday information, recipes, and lots of stuff from all the Food Fridays. So go to the Vox Pop page, and then you'll find Food Friday from there. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, Colleen O'Connell, who took your calls. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. Thanks again for joining us on Vox Pop. I'm Ray Graff. Next week, we kick it off with Alan Shartok and Medical Monday. Stay tuned now for a news update. Have a great weekend.